The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
With me this morning is Colm O'Gorman, former director of 1 in 4 and Amnesty International, Sarah McGuinness, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and Pather Tobin, TD leader of AIM2. And Pather, I will start with you because there is a lot in the papers this weekend about the issue of Children's Health Ireland, about delays for scoliosis surgery, and about the parents of Harvey Morrison saying that it's only a matter of time, in their view, this is on the front of the Sunday Times, before another child dies because of issues at Children's Health Ireland, which, of course, is the hospital network responsible ultimately for his care. Now, this is something that you have been very vocal about during the week, going so far as to call for the resignation of Simon Harris. Is that a bit much?
But first of all, just when I think of it, there is a protest gathering next Saturday at the Garden of Remembrance at 2 p.m. To see can we actually put pressure on the government to reform what is a dysfunctional basket case, which is CHI. And I would really ask people who have any interest in this space to come along to that meeting. Harvey was, by all accounts, a wonderful child, a child by which his family's life revolved around. In that short period of time, he suffered enormous pain and suffering, and he was denied healthcare in this country. We had a situation where he was promised that he would have his operation in March 2022. In April 23, it was cancelled. And then he was taken off the waiting list without his family or himself being even told. So at the centre of this, we have a Simon Harris, who is Minister for Health. And in 2017, he explicitly underwrote a promise to every child on that waiting list that they would not wait longer than 4 months for an operation. And that would be in place before the end of that particular year. He went on to be the minister right up until 2020. Now, we know that in Harvey's case, he waited 33 months for an operation. The curvature of his spine went to 130 degrees. After 100 degrees curvature, it is the threat to the child's life when that happens. And the fact that this is happening in the background of CHI being in complete dysfunction. Remember, CHI been in the news recently, first of all, for allowing for unauthorised springs to be implanted in children, for allowing for potentially hundreds of operations to happen on children's hips where children did not meet the threshold for those operations. So operations happening on children who didn't need them and that it possibly damaged them. And we had a situation where nine reports have been written on CHI at this stage, but one of those reports said that there has been toxic management within that particular organisation and that public money has not been spent with proper due diligence in relation to it. And remember, this is the organisation that is implementing the transition to the National Children's Hospital. And I just cannot believe that such level of dysfunction, such damaging this level of dysfunction has been allowed to happen for so long. And that we have an individual who has been at the heart of that crisis, Simon Harris, for so long. Now, we either have a cost to this level of dysfunction, and I believe that accountability is one of the most important things that can happen within the political system. It is potentially a catalyst for serious transformative change within the health service.
Oh, sorry, when you say accountability, do you want the accountability for the failure to deliver on the waiting times that were promised? Do you want accountability for the CHI mismanagement or the culture that exists within? Or is it just that you want a head?
I believe that there should be accountability for the failure to deliver operations within 33 months for Harvey. And remember this, waiting lists are increasing at the moment. There's 233 children on those waiting lists at the moment. There's a number of those children who are waiting 3, 4, and 5 years. There's a rake of children who are waiting up to 9 months currently. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel of this improving. And
now, do you know why the operations were delayed? Have you gotten the detail as to what the reasoning was for that? Because it could be for medical reasons, it could be pressure in the system.
So in Harvey's case, I don't. But I do know that in Harvey's case, there was a clinical decision to have an operation. In Harvey's case, an operation did happen last November, but far too late. So I'm not arguing on the basis of the clinician's decisions here. I don't have the ability to do that. But what I am arguing is that there's a political system which is failing beyond any measure whatsoever, failing these children. And the problem is, in this country, we seem to have no threshold for accountability anymore. Like, losing a child is the most serious thing that can happen to a family. You know, if we do not have a threshold for accountability on the basis of this, where does it lie in future? And this is the key issue in Irish politics is that there's no cost ever for anybody making a bad decision or not fulfilling their responsibilities. The individual that's currently has a responsibility to transition from the current children's hospital structure into the National Children's Hospital is the person who was a CEO of CHI throughout all of this dysfunction. Like, that's mind-blowing to me that could happen. And that's why I think that Simon Harris should resign.
There have been a number of reports done into Children's Health Ireland and, of course, the Children's Hospital now coming to completion, albeit with delays. It's an odd situation to have one of the more expensive capital investments in our health system in our history get handed to an organisation which has a cloud over it like this, Colm, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I mean, if we look back even more systemically at what's happening within our health system, I mean, to be fair, Padder's not calling simply for a head on a plate, and that's very clear from everything that he's just said there. But we have an appalling history of lurching from scandal to scandal and never really getting to grips what's happening within our health system. And I would agree, there's very little political accountability, but there's also very little accountability from within the system. Mm. People made decisions.
Well, it's interesting, as you speak, a text has just come in saying, Simon Harris is one man at the top. When will the civil and public servants who actually run the Department of Health and HSE and CHI be accountable? There's no consequences.
I agree that there's no consequences there. Now I'm going to balance what the caller has just said, reinforcing the point that I was making. I mean, there is also a question of political responsibility and accountability here. I mean, Gary Murphy has an excellent piece in the Sunday Times where he talks about how the scoliosis sledge is coming back to haunt Simon Harris. As everybody knows, in 2017, Simon Harris said that they were going to make sure that by the end of that year, by the end of 2017, no child waits in this country longer for a scoliosis procedure than 4 months. He then goes on to say politicians make promises all of the time. This is Gary Murphy. But there's something inherently wrong about making a guarantee that simply cannot be kept when it is made about that most precious of groups, sick children. We have a political system where politicians can make promises on a whole range of things and nobody really expects them to keep them. I mean, is that what we're talking about here? Did Simon Harris make a promise in 2017 in this case that there was no real possibility of him being able to deliver on? And a very specific promise that by the end of that year, no child would wait longer than 4 months. I think he does need to explain the basis upon which he made that commitment, how he felt confident that he could do it, and what follow-up happened to ensure that there was a plan in place to deliver on that promise. It's a very specific and very significant promise. And it undermines confidence in our political system if people can make those kind of promises and effectively walk away from them when it all goes wrong. So there needs to be that accountability. But back to that core point as well, we need an accountability. For so long we've been saying, and Gary Murphy goes on to say it as well, it's not a matter of money. Successive governments have invested massively in health. The health budget has grown exponentially over the last 15 years, as it should and as it needs to. But we're not seeing the kind of improvements in outcomes that we might expect to see, particularly in areas such as this. So there needs to be systems levels accountability. And it's not enough to say, oh, it's Angola or the health system is irrepealable. In a country of our size, given the amount of money that we spent on health, between direct investment in public health systems and the money that people spend on paying for health insurance, we should have a great health system. And in some regards, we really...
Can Simon Harris, do you think, point to the upheaval of COVID and say that, 18 months after that promise was given, we were hit with a global pandemic which had a major impact on the health service and skewed everything?
Not in the case of Children's Health Ireland, I don't think. I think in many cases, yes, he can, but not in the case of CHI Ireland. And I don't think that Simon Harris is going to resign about this. I cannot see a world in which this is the end of Simon Harris's political career. But reading, and anyone who has the capacity to go out and buy a paper today, please, the Sunday Times, John Mooney's reporting and his conversation with Stephen Morrison, Harvey's father, is just so like moving. And you see, I'm kind of torn because I'm reading that conversation and I'm reading about how Stephen promised his son Harvey, this 9-year-old child who's passing away, that he will campaign so that other children don't face the same fate. And absolutely, I agree that there is no accountability, and I feel that anger as well. But ultimately, you know, like that's so bigger picture that I also am thinking about the fact that this is a very specific team of consultants that these issues keep cropping up with time and time again. And I think this is one tangible thing. Like, this isn't the housing crisis. This isn't something behemoth. This is one team of clinical, of consultants who are orthopedics, children's surgeons, that this keeps happening with. And this could be weeded out quite quickly, you know, but it just hasn't been.
Heather Unica.
Yeah, you mentioned there, where does the responsibility lie? And I had a senior member of the Department of Health in before me in a finance committee there about 18 months ago. And I asked that senior civil servant, in his experience, in the 40 years that he worked there, had he ever seen anybody ever lose their job for anything that went wrong in the HSC? And he said no. So now I'm not looking for heads on a plate, but I am looking.
Well, you are.
Well, what I am looking for is a reform of the situation. I am looking for that there is, that if things go wrong, that first of all, you help try to fix the situation. You give extra support, so you, maybe extra training, that people don't get promotions if they do things wrong, that and that ultimately that there is a cost for doing something wrong. Now, that is not a novel idea. That's what happens in every other walk of life other than senior civil service and the political system. It is what actually keeps everything actually working properly within those systems, and we need to make sure that it happens within the public service too.
Text say, whoever made the decision to take Harvey off the waiting list should be held responsible. My mother was also taken off the waiting list, and it was against outpatient protocol, which I was aware of, so they had to put her back on the waiting list. No responsibility whatsoever. Another, we're supposed to be a wealthy country. Are we or are we not? If we are, where's the money going? Why is there any waiting list at all? Follow the money, because we spend more than most on public health, both public and private. Colin, that was the point that you were making. We have repeatedly been told it's not about money.
Yeah, absolutely. But back to Sarah's point there again, because this is such, for want of a better phrase, a niche issue, right? A narrow issue in terms of delivery, right? In terms of the delivery of health supports and procedures. It's got to be fixable. In any reasonable system where you're talking about a small team of people and quite a small group of patients as well, if there was, you would have thought if there was the, never mind the will, but even the wit to fix it, it would be fixed. So it's very, very telling that even in an area such as this, our health system and our political system cannot intervene to make it work. That is alarming. When you think about what that means for broader reform within the health systems and health outcomes for people across a whole range of issues.
I genuinely am deeply concerned about CHI, and as Pat alluded to, the running of the new National Children's Hospital with an organisation in the state of disarray. Even like watching CHI and Lucy Nugent, who to be fair came into this role in January to an organisation in crisis. I am not attributing anything to her. I don't know her. But just, it's genuinely astounding. The 2021 report, again, uncovered by John Mooney and published, in which it detailed how some consultants were putting children on different waiting lists and seeing them in outpatient clinics, whereby they would earn far more money. One consultant earned, I think, €35,000 for seven outpatient clinics or five outpatient clinics. It's genuinely astounding. And that's just a day's work. Like, but that report won't be published. CHI is seemingly battled with like legal threats on all sides. Nothing is being done. It is in total stagnation. And the national, I'm just so concerned about it. It is genuinely, I think, one of the biggest crises in government at the moment.
Well, if you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be getting analysis on the outcome of that summit between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, and also a bit of a discussion around what European leaders are going to do in terms of response, because they have been very much left out in the cold of this process so far. But just to touch off it a little, I didn't think I would ever do this, but let me quote Boris Johnson from his piece in the Mail. He has written a searing analysis, which begins, well, that was just about the most vomit-inducing episode in all the tawdry history of international diplomacy. It made the gorge rise to see Putin welcomed on American soil. It was emetic to see him applauded on the red carpet. It was nauseating to watch his golem-like smirk as he became one of the only world leaders I can think of to be invited to ride in the back of the presidential limo. It was positively chunderous to hear him given an American platform for his lies. He might be right.
Well, no less than you, Anton, I was sickened at the thoughts of having to read anything that Boris had to say about anything. But I mean, I suppose one of the reflections I had is that man has no level of self-awareness at all in terms of what he says. I mean, towards the end of the article, and I'll deal with the substance of what you said in a moment, towards the end of the article, this is the closing paragraph from that article. What about Europe? When are we going to have the courage to do the same? This is our continent. I mean, this from the man who did more to dismantle European cooperation and European effectiveness than perhaps anybody else bar Nigel Farage. Yeah, he's staggering. I mean, on the
summit... Doesn't mean his analysis is wrong.
No, I mean, his analysis isn't wrong, but it's also noteworthy that not one place in the piece does he say anything really that's particularly critical of Donald Trump. You know, he's nauseated that Putin has been given this platform, that Putin has been welcomed in this way, that Putin has been put in the back of Trump's car. By who? I mean, all of this theatre, all of this circus was created by, facilitated by and amped up by Donald Trump. And yet what Trump did was deliver Putin a stunning victory. I mean, he allowed somebody... I mean, war criminals are very often welcomed, including those from Western democracies, very well often welcomed in each other's countries. But he allowed Putin a level of, and I think this is particularly relevant within Russia, rehabilitation, international rehabilitation that was unthinkable even a few months ago.
That seems to be the general consensus of a lot of the analysis, that it is a rehab for Putin.
Yeah, and I would encourage anyone with interest in the subject not to maybe read Boris Johnson, but instead there is a fabulous piece in the Sindo on page 19 by a Ukrainian journalist who basically sums up the... who gives, I think, a very fair analysis. She describes it as weird, embarrassing, but not yet disastrous. But anyway, in this piece, she touches on the fact that this was kind of a pantomime of self-reassurance for two very kind of insecure men. But ultimately, you know, for Putin, a lot of this is it's given him a credibility that he has not had previously and that will play very well for him. But ultimately, you know, giving him that credibility is the biggest gamble in the world because you're essentially, you're legitimizing what he is doing.
But he's also walked away with the pressure for a ceasefire removed. So yeah. Now a ceasefire is not in the option. It's about a cessation of war. It's about ending the war. That's now the focus. He's walked away without the threat of secondary sanctions. That's been removed. And at the same time, Russia is ramping up its assault on Ukraine. So Putin has been stunningly successful. You know, effectively, they've been now able to, they're able to prolong the process through which they might ultimately be forced to engage meaningfully with any proposal for peace, whilst they continue to expand their occupation of parts of Ukraine. So they're allowed to get on with the war. They're allowed to continue to target Ukraine in the way that they have. And any leverage that Trump had said he would use has been taken off the table.
Heather?
Yeah, I think that it's important to look at the level of human destruction that's actually happened so far. Mm. So I think there's 1 million Russian casualties between deaths and also people who have been seriously injured. I think there's 400,000 Ukrainian casualties between deaths and those who've been injured. And there's tens of thousands of Ukrainian citizens who have been killed. I come from that kind of Good Friday Agreement instinct that the only way that you're going to actually achieve peace is through negotiations. And you have to negotiate with the aggressor to achieve peace. I think that there's not going to be peace in Ukraine unless there is some form of negotiations. The positive that
to do that, doesn't the aggressor have to be in a position where they have something tangible they can lose? And the main entity that can put them in that position is America, and they're not doing it.
Well, there's two elements here. I think that there's been a positive for Ukraine in terms of the fact that the worry was initially that Trump was going to get involved in a land swap agreement and therefore create a situations where the Ukrainians have had to agree with it. That didn't happen. And I think that's a positive. The worry I have for Ukraine at the moment is that the wind seems to be behind the Russian invasion. Even at the moment, that they seem to be winning in a very limited fashion. There's only a 1% increase in land achieved so far this year. But as long as that happens, it's not going to be in Putin's interest to actually call a ceasefire. I still think that's a positive that didn't happen because that was a danger. I do think what we need really is European nations to stand up in terms of providing some kind of security in the future for the likes of Ukraine.
On the topic of the CHI and public health in general, it's the elephant in the room. Says a text, civil and public servants cannot be sacked for gross underperformance. What about the overrun on the new children's hospital? No consequences for the Department of Health officials or anybody in the system who made bad decisions. In fairness, Pather's party are the only ones beating a drum on it. Please beat it louder, says the text. We do need to talk about the presidential election, because there's, of course, the ongoing speculation as to who is going to run. And there's an analysis of the campaigns thus far of those who have declared, including Gareth Sheridan, who it appears pulled the pin from the grenade and then lay on it during the week, given the analysis of much of how it has gone thus far. Sarah was at that press conference where he announced his candidacy. With presidential election speculation as to whether or not Heather Humphreys is going to be the Fine Gael candidate. Sean Kelly, of course, on this programme yesterday, not really taking a position, but showing some thinly veiled enthusiasm for the role. There's also analysis and discussion about Gareth Sheridan, who threw his hat in the ring. And the front of the Business Post saying, Sheridan backtracks on claim Nutriband, this is his NASDAQ-listed company, generates up to €6 million. It actually apparently generates €2 million a year despite a NASDAQ listing. You were at the launch of this campaign, Sarah. What was it like?
Oh, bizarre. So it was in the constitutional room of the Shelburne Hotel. And for someone who is trying to come across as a man for the people, giving young people something worth voting for, I don't think the Shelburne is necessarily the location for that. But anyway, yeah, it was really bizarre. And Pather, I mean this with no disrespect, he would make a fine opposition TD. He is very, you know, he'd make a fine speechwriter for the Social Democrats. He is talking about going in and starting a conversation on housing and doing everything that a president essentially shouldn't really do. He is quite personable. Like, he is trying to come across as very humble, and I would say kind of succeeding in doing so. But ultimately, I left it and I still cannot figure out why he wants to run for president of Ireland. And he has asked numerous times, and his argument has been, because I just really care. But actually, the most he sounded like he cared about anything was at the top of the press conference, which is when he had a knock at people in Sean Gallagher's circles for launching a coordinated attack on him. And
this is because of some spat between him and Sean Gallagher over the company's purchase or renting of a corporate box at a basketball
game. So for anyone who might not be familiar, Sean Gallagher, former Dragon's Den
and presidential candidate
in 2011, was the chairman of Nutriband, Gareth Sheridan's company in the US. The story goes that he stepped down in 2021, according to Gareth Sheridan, because they wanted a new chairperson who had a bit more market experience, and they were going to keep him on as a director on the same role. But eventually, Sean Gallagher, by the sounds of it, according to Gareth Sheridan, threw his toys out of the pram and walked. But someone has told the Irish Independent, and they have stood that up, that actually part of it was to do with the corporate box at a Florida basketball station and a dispute over that. It's so murky. It's so wishy-washy. I don't really buy any of it. And I think that that's a fundamental flaw as well with Gareth Sheridan so far. I haven't bought anything that he's trying to sell me. And I am his target voter. I am 24. I am renting.
And what about the revelations in respect to the company? Because the Business Post is now saying that this company has made a maximum of $2 million of revenues and has racked up losses of $40 million. Now, that's common in a high-growth startup where you have frontal investment. But for the CEO in that moment, before it has become revenue generative and profitable, to say, I'm away to become president, seems odd.
The whole thing is bizarre. And he's saying he'll go back if he doesn't get it, if he doesn't get the presidency. He's renting a house in Ireland at the minute. He's saying he'd stay in Ireland, but he hasn't purchased a property yet. Maybe because he's holding hope that he can move into the Phoenix Park. But
that's the way he'd make Ireland home again.
Absolutely. There's a lovely home waiting for him in the Phoenix Park if he is in South. But yeah, it's just the whole thing is truly bizarre. And it's something that people are just going to keep digging into. And I suppose when the kind of bombshell announcement came in the Sindo last weekend, it was very much kind of pharma tycoon wants to come home to, to run for the presidency. And it seemed like this kind of very, like, he was a bit of a bombshell, but now it's kind of like the more and more we're learning about it, we're kind of like, oh, like...
Well, can I ask on this, Pather, as somebody who has been round the block a bit in terms of politics, is there a responsibility on whoever is advising or running the campaign to say, look, let's look at all of the hairs that are going to start running as soon as we start this thing and make sure we have answers for them before you start?
Listen, I just think this is one of the most bizarre campaigns that I've ever seen. So a person who's come from nowhere is now front page news all over the newspapers. He seems to be in reverse completely in terms of his election campaign. It reminds me of the ad, you know, I don't know what a tracker mortgage is. I don't know who Gareth Sheridan is, and I don't think anybody knows. And also the first thing that your campaign should be on values. Like if the presidential election stands for anything, it stands for your contribution to our society. It stands for your ability to have experience, make really good decisions, and the values that you want to espouse. And whoever gets elected is usually the person who reflects the values of society. And despite all the columnists, I don't know who Gareth Sheridan is. I don't know what he stands for. I don't know what his values are.
But if he is what he purports to be, which is a young entrepreneur, somebody who has made it from working class roots into major success, somebody who is concerned about the capacity for young Irish people of his generation to be able to buy homes for themselves and be successful in Ireland, does he not personify those very values that you're describing?
Well, I don't think concern is a qualification for the presidential election. I think that those concerns transferred into well-thought-out solutions, into well-thought-out positions, into well-thought-out values is actually what's needed. And, you know, I think this the whole Gareth Sheridan element could be like silly season element of it politically. I think actually what this election is a weird election. We have no presidential
election. Aren't they
election.
All, though? Aren't
no,
all
but this is particularly weird. We have a political establishment so far who hasn't been able to put up a candidate as of yet. Like, we have Catherine Connolly, who's a fine candidate in her own right. But the two biggest political parties have no candidate at all. Fianna Fáil look like they're not likely to have a candidate, I think, at this stage. You know, the idea, I think they're worried about putting up 500,000 euros and not getting anything for their money at the end of it. And it also shows to a certain extent that those political parties are not vehicles of values anymore, because if they were about values, they'd be jumping at the opportunity to actually change the political narrative, to affect the political discussion.
Through the presidency?
Yeah. You know, Catherine Connolly is going to use this presidential election to set forth her view of what Ireland should be. And that's what anybody from the whole political spectrum should be doing. And neither of those two political parties have done it yet. Now, I know, obviously, Fine Gael are a little bit different, that they're likely to select somebody. But I think this is a weird presidential election.
You fancied yourself, Colin?
No. No, and if anybody's looking at the... I get texts every now and again, or social media posts.
I'd say that's love.
Saying, oh, are you going to put more... Like, what is it? Paddy Power has me at 200 to 1 or something. Please do not waste your money. It's never, ever, ever going to happen. It's not going to happen. I would never... put myself in that position, or more importantly, put my family in that position. I think it's an awful campaign for anybody to have to engage with. I mean, as it happens, I actually do think that Fianna Fáil are likely to put up a candidate, and I think they would probably disagree strongly with Padder's view that they don't have a...
And is it going to be Bertie Ahern? Because a lot of...
If it's Bertie Ahern, I mean, part of me really wants it to be Bertie Ahern, because I think that will be, you know, and that's the worst part of me that wants it to be Bertie Ahern, because I think it'll be an S show if that's the case, right? The whole thing, I don't think it will be. I mean, Micheál Martin clearly doesn't want it to be Bertie Ahern. I mean, in the Sunday Independent little snap poll that they ran this week, he's at 14%, up there with Mary Lou MacDonald, only 4 points behind Catherine Connolly, with Heather Humphreys, who it looks like, based on Sarah's reporting this week, it looks like will definitely be the Fine Gael candidate. And actually, I do think Heather Humphreys, if she enters the election, will become the lead candidate very, very quickly indeed, because I think she's got huge cross-societal appeal. Not, I wouldn't limit it to cross-party appeal, because I don't think that's the point. She's got enormous cross-societal appeal.
All right, Sarah, this is your area of expertise. Heather Humphrey going to get the Fine Gael nod?
I am telling you now, Heather Humphreys is going to get the Fine Gael nod.
What about Sean Kelly? He's fierce popular.
So this is how... I think there will be a competition. I think it probably will be a competition between Heather and Sean, but the party's leadership has thrown its weight behind Heather. I rang around the PP on Thursday evening. So Mairead McGuinness... told Simon Harris that she could not go ahead on Monday. And since then, there have kind of been plans in place. The statement went out at 4 p.m. on Thursday afternoon, and by the time the evening was out, everyone that I spoke to in Fine Gael is saying it's going to be Heather, you know? Like, and the party seemed to back her. There would be people, obviously, who would, you know, still hold Sean Kelly in very high regard and do hold Sean Kelly in very high regard. But I just can't foresee a universe in which Heather Humphreys does not emerge. And it's interesting, she actually, Mary Regan seemingly spoke to her. It was in the Sunday Independent that she's saying that she's reconsidering her once very staunch view that she will never go for it. I think she's the most likely option.
Now, what about Fianna Fáil? Because there is some good tinfoil hattery been knocking around at the moment, saying things like Micheál Martin would like a weak candidate so that 7 years later he can cut the legs out from under them and take the job.
God, that's very... Jeez, people are very cynical, aren't they? But no, I ultimately do think that Micheál Martin is waiting Sinn Féin out to see what they do. And also, to be fair, it's not the most pressing thing on their list at the moment. Like, Fianna Fáil are the top of government at the minute. They currently have no much money. They have no idea how much money they have to play with in the budget. They're still trying to figure that out. They have a housing plan that is meant to replace Housing for All.
They kind of have to have a presidential candidate, don't they?
They do, but I think that they're kind of like, we'll figure this out. Like, there are much more pressing issues, which I think will be much more important to Micheál Martin and his legacy, which he is much more laser-focused on than Áras an Uachtaráin. I do think he's waiting Sinn Féin out as well, seeing what they're doing.
In a funny way, one of the things that I do actually find quite appealing about Heather Humphreys is that she seems to be a reluctant candidate. I quite like that. I almost think that if somebody really wants to be president, we should be really questioning, well, why do you want
Gerald
to be president?
Gerald has ruled herself out twice. She should be your ideal then.
But do you know what I mean? It's like, if for somebody who's that hungry, I mean, for me, one of the, and I should say this is not a personal attack on Mairead McGuinness as well, and I wish her well. It's a very difficult set of circumstances for her. But she wanted it so badly. Like, since 2011, she's wanted to be president. I've never understood why. Like, back to the Gareth Sheridan point, I'm really trying to learn his name properly, much of the country for the next few weeks at least anyway. But like, I really, if somebody wants to stand for president, I really want to know why. Mm-hmm. And it really needs not to be about because it's, you know, the office. It's the idea, the attraction of the office. I really want to understand why.
But it's desperately difficult to justify your reasons for going for a position which is largely ceremonial.
So you still have to be able to do it. Yeah, it is largely ceremonial, but we have had our last three presidents have done something quite extraordinary with that office, despite the cynical approach of Shane Coleman in today's Sunday Business Post, who's dismissed that entirely, saying he doesn't want anybody who's done any of the things that the last three presidents have done. I laughed when I read the piece saying Shane clearly wants Paddy Hillary, and he ends the piece saying he wanted Paddy Hillary to be president. Shane wants the kind of president who'll go up to the Oris, pull the door behind him and never be heard from again. What we've seen over the last 35 years is presidents who've really, really done something with that office, who've had a huge impact on Irish life and Irish society and Irish public discourse. And we need more of that.
Colm, thank you. Likewise, thank you to Sarah and to Pather.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.